The participants in my small group said. And they veered from someone who found that they applied the Buddha's teachings or in a perhaps overcomplicated way, maybe missing the point by being too methodical about it, applying, you know, perhaps trying, they talked of taking one of the Eightfold Path one day and trying to apply that, and then another factor of the Eightfold Path another day, and this is interesting but not helpful. And then there was somebody who mentioned another way that they found that life was quite, you know, the teaching wasn't too complicated, but life was rather overcomplicated, how they could overcomplicate daily life. Wondered if those perhaps teachings, the Buddha's teachings might, that they could apply to simplify. And another person who felt that life was a process of simplification and they'd been working on it for some time and gaining some benefit from that, which had originated from their understanding of Buddhism. So some various and different ways to reflect on this theme. I had many questions. I'm not going to be able to answer them all. And in fact, so many. I could even feel overfaced by them. So I'm not going to be able to answer them all, but I'll pick up one or two of them. One of the questions I had was, where does all of the Buddha's teachings fit within the context of the Four Noble Truths? If the Four Noble Truths is all we need to know, and so thinking about this, the Eightfold Path, the Fourth Noble Truth, which is the Eightfold Path, then you can see how in many different ways the teachings develop the theme of sila, which is morality, samadhi, which is concentration or mental development, and panya, which is wisdom or insight. So you could see how the teachings could fall within these three groups. And the Eightfold Path is in those three groups. So the right understanding is that is obviously developed in different suttas in different contexts. Mindfulness is developed in different suttas in more detail, far more detail. The Satipatthana Sutta, for example, explains in detail the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness. There are some very useful suttas about right speech and right action. So there are many helpful suttas that develop the Eightfold Path in different ways. I think that our task is not to overcomplicate. I think that's within us. How do we apply the teachings? So do we have the right attitude, the right approach? Well, you can see how in the right understanding and the right attitude, those first two factors of the Eightfold Path, can inform the way we approach the suttas. So are we using them for the purpose they're intended, which is to free us from suffering, from free us from dukkha. So if we're using them as some sort of mental ping pong to argue with somebody else and say, oh, well, it says this here, so we can refute what the other person has said. Or if we're just doing it, finding fault, saying, well, it doesn't seem to be consistent with what I've read in another place. The Buddha said this there, and then he said this here. That's a kind of mental ping pong, isn't it? And that's not particularly helpful. There may well be suttas or teachings that we can at the moment lay aside because they're not helping. We don't understand. And it's fine to not understand. One of the key parts and teachings around right understanding is the willingness not to understand. We're not saying we know everything. We're saying we're willing to learn. That doesn't mean that we have to learn from everything right now. We might just find one thing that's useful that we need to know right now and really develop that and find that beneficial. And another thing which, rather than creating a problem out of a sense of not really understanding it, we could just lay it aside and maybe it will fall into place or maybe it won't. It doesn't really, you know, we don't need to create suffering out of the teaching. That's not what it's there for. It's fine not to understand. It's fine to say, I'll have to leave that one to one side for the moment. And maybe when I've investigated something else, then it will fall into place. Like a jigsaw puzzle. You don't make a jigsaw puzzle by fitting all the pieces at once. You create areas through finding pieces that match and gradually build up, don't you, from in one place, in one area. So you collect these related pieces together and you build up the jigsaw in that area. And then you realize that these other pieces start to fit too. And perhaps you build those together and then you create another area that you can build up. And then eventually they start to fall into place until you're always left with two or three that you think don't fit. They'll never fit. And then eventually you discover that they do. And it's complete. And everything's falling into place. And it's like building a jigsaw like that. So it's okay to leave something aside thinking, I've no idea where that goes. That's without creating a problem out of it. So that was a kind of answer to that. One or two people asked questions that were similar to that. Well, just as an example, I love your message of not overcomplicating things, but the Dhamma is so vast. Thousands of suttas, commentaries, Buddhist books and more. How do we find a system of practice that is complete without worrying that there's something we've missed or left out? How do we recognize when we have enough information to form a complete practice? Well, if the wonderful thing about, you know, one of the core teachings of this practice is to notice, isn't it? Mindfulness. So if we notice that we're worrying, that we might have, you know, whether or not we might have left something out, then that's worrying. So we can notice that. It's a balance. We can, obviously, in any, we could just pick and choose the Buddhist teachings and practice the part of the teachings that we like and push the rest to one side. And that is a way to practice. On the other hand, the mind's very tricky, and we very often don't find attractive the thing that we most would benefit from. So it's often the case with loving kindness. When somebody says to me, I can't stand practicing loving kindness, I hate it, and I think, I think that's got something to teach you. And it's often the case, isn't it, that the thing that we'd most benefit from, we would rather push to one side. So we have to learn, understand the mind, the way the mind works. Martin spoke skillfully on what the Buddha explained regarding what we shouldn't do, i.e. not grasp, not cling or attach, or have or a concrete idea of self. But would he share some thoughts on what we should do, i.e. right action, right livelihood, reduce the suffering in the world? I think I did talk about right action and right livelihood, but as I said, in terms of what we should do, the Buddha's not prescriptive about that, rather what we should avoid. And that gives us a certain amount of freedom, doesn't it? That's what makes the teachings eternal. In a sense, they're timeless, because they're always available to, they fit even the modern day situation, because the Buddha's not saying, right, livelihood has to be this. He's just saying, no, it shouldn't be that. Avoid harming others is something that is timeless, isn't it? But the question of does it mean we, you know, is there something we should be doing? It says, isn't there something we should be doing to reduce the suffering in the world? It does seem sometimes, I think, that Buddhism is, obviously it's a contemplative religion. It's about understanding the mind, the way the mind works. And when we understand, when we let go of delusion, we see things more clearly, we're in a much better position to do something useful in the world. But the Buddha's not, that isn't the Buddhism, in a sense. We don't have to do it in the name of Buddhism. And I think that that's often the case. Many people who practice Buddhism do a lot of wonderful things in their lives, but they don't do it in the name of Buddhism. So we can get the impression that Buddhists don't do anything in the world because they're not putting a label Buddhist behind it. It's not the idea of Buddhism isn't to set up a Buddhist hospital, for example, and say, well, if you have to convert to Buddhism to go to hospital. That isn't the Buddha's teaching. It's not the way to practice. It's always for everyone. Everything, the teaching is for everyone. What we do is for everyone. It's not for only for Buddhist people. We don't tend to do much in the name of Buddhism in terms of helping, in terms of avoiding reducing the suffering of the world, but that doesn't mean we wouldn't reduce the suffering of the world. Of course, why wouldn't we? And people do many good, wonderful things. I'll move on, because as I say, there's quite a lot of questions here. Could you say something about the difference between thinking and reflecting? It's quite a difficult question, that. Obviously, it's often the case, we look at the mind, and often in meditation practice, we might be encouraged to say, come back to the breath or come back to an object in order to step back from the busy mind so that we're not carried away with thoughts. And I did talk about the dreamscape that we can create and how it can so easily carry us away and we don't see clearly. It's not, the Buddha talked about waking up, and that to wake up is to see through the way the mind creates this sort of dream world. That's the opposite of dreaming, isn't it? Waking up. And but we're not despising the mind, the mind, but the capacity to reflect, the power of the ability of the mind to reflect is a tool that we use and we can develop. And so what is reflecting? Well, how do we reflect? I think it is, as I was saying, that we don't tell, we don't say we know the answer. We are willing to learn. So we'll let's say, as I used an example, when the mind's angry, our willingness to sustain our attention through to the end means that's what the reflective mind is. We're not telling ourselves that we shouldn't think this way, that we shouldn't be angry, and pushing it away. But we're willing to see it through to the end, which means we without interfering with it, we're watching it, we're observing it, and let this is the reflective process in a sense. We know very well, we've read already, that everything's impermanent, but we're not telling it's impermanent, we're letting it tell us. So the reflective mind is a kind of unconditional observation, a scientific observation, so that the without like a scientist doesn't tell doesn't impose what they think the result is on the experiment. They let the experiment reveal the result, and if that result corresponds to results they've seen elsewhere, then they draw the conclusion that's true. But if they go to the experiment with that mindset of thinking they know what the result is, then they see what they're looking for. They influence their research with what they're expecting to find. So the reflective mind doesn't say, I know what I'm looking for. It's that capacity to see what there is. That's the reality. And then to realize the something new. So it takes us outside the conditioned way of thinking. Our conditioned mind is what we already know. Realizing the unconditioned is the opening up to what isn't, what we've not seen before. It's walking off the edge of the conditioned world we already know. So that's what I think is about reflecting, the capacity to reflect. We're still using the mind, but we're not believing in it, if you like. We're not believing in the conditioned way it thinks, because that's coming out of conditionality, but we're letting go. We're deliberately letting go of that sense of what we already know. We're using, like the mantra Ajahn Chah used to talk about, was not sure. So we're approaching whatever the mind tells us with not sure. So that's the essence of investigation. You see what the mind, what's the mind tells us it is, and yet still we don't believe it. We say, are you sure? And when we investigate that way, we discover a deeper truth and another layer of truth that's lower, deeper than that. That the first thing we think of is often that the way we've been conditioned to think. But as we develop that capacity to reflect, we go deeper and deeper, and until we see through the conditioned mind into the reality, which is, in fact, as Ajahn Sumedho, it's like this, would say, it's like this. In other words, it's just for you to go and find out how it is. You would find out for yourself. That's what the reflective mind does. It discovers the truth. It doesn't matter however much or whatever anyone else says, you discover the truth for yourself. I've got a nice question here. I don't know, I hope I'm not going on too long. And I've got time. Somebody says, why is kindness needed in seeing the truth? Because otherwise we would use the critical mind. You know, that's what unkindness is, isn't it? We would be critical. We wouldn't listen. I would say, inner listening is an act of kindness. It's not judging. So we have to listen, be willing to listen unconditionally. And also, certainly in my practice, I've found the development of loving kindness has been essential. Not only kindness, but also forgiveness. So, because that, when I cultivated loving kindness, that created a very beautiful state of mind. It's a really beautiful experience. And so then in that blissful state, then letting go from that, letting it go, we're letting go of something that's beautiful. That's the genuine letting go. If you let go out of something that you don't like, then we already want to get rid of it, don't we? So there's not really a letting go in that. We're pushing it away. We're very good at pushing away things we don't like. So the genuine letting go is best done when it's something that's really beautiful. So if you, when I experience the love, the joy that comes out of loving kindness, then, and I really investigated that, when I saw through that, I saw that that was created. I was creating that through conditions. I was creating that sense of joy by cultivating loving kindness. I realized it was created. And therefore, and it wasn't permanent. It couldn't last. And that sense of letting go from that, I let go, the insight that came from letting go from that was that's in my experience. That was very deep. Whereas I think if I'd have not developed the heart to that extent, I would have perhaps not been letting go from the right place. We were letting go of this, the sense of what's joyful, blissful, to realize, it's a lot to give up, isn't it? It's a hard thing. You would say that's quite hard to do. It's a lot to give up. But we're giving it up for to understand things as they are. So we're realizing a deeper truth. You know, we're giving up joy for truth. We're giving up bliss for truth. And truth is more powerful because bliss is impermanent, but truth isn't. You know, when you realize truth, it doesn't go away. That insight doesn't go. It's there. Once you've seen something clearly, you can't not see it. You see it forever. So it's a great, it's a shift in our way of seeing that's of much greater value than that blissful experience that was impermanent. So it's, you know, that I found that in my experience, yes, kindness was needed for me to see the truth. It's just how that was how it worked for me anyway. Well, I think maybe there's a. Well, I've got a few more questions if you can bear with me. Oh, there's some that came in later. How do we know we are having a direct experience of reality rather than a thought? We are having a direct experience of reality. This is a good question because we can easily make it up. You know, the mind's incredibly powerful, incredibly clever. We can easily make up something and call it reality, can't we? And this is terribly difficult, terribly tricky. So how do we know the difference between direct experience of reality rather than the thought we are having a direct experience of reality? And maybe the helpful guide is well, in a way, it takes a long time. Sometimes it takes a long time to see through this. One thing which can be helpful is, are we creating delusion? So, for example, something that can happen is we think we've had a direct experience of reality. We know something. And so we look around at people and we think that we can say, oh, that person is deluded. And I'm not deluded. And that very thought is a deluded thought, isn't it? Because we're creating somebody out there who's deluded and we're creating somebody in here who isn't. So although we may have experienced a direct experience of reality somewhere along the line, we haven't freed ourselves from this way of creating a self in our somebody who's experienced this and a self of somebody out there who hasn't. Because of our lack of insight, not seeing that clearly, not seeing that delusion, we believe that what we're seeing is reality. There is out there this deluded person, and in here there's this person who isn't. And that's a delusion, but we can't see it. And it sometimes takes somebody to point that out. It's helpful sometimes when somebody can say that we are creating, you know, we're making that person into somebody. We're creating a self in another person, that person, that difficult person. We're creating that person with who's like this. And we're also creating the person in us who sees that, who knows that clearly. When in fact, we're not, you know, the reality is it's all deluded. It's a delusion. We're creating a delusion. You know, the self-creation that we're imposing on somebody else, we're turning them into somebody, that's not true. We're just making that up about who they are. And we're also making up ourselves this idea of, I am somebody who knows. I know this and that, they, you know, I'm I'm the one who's superior, and they're the inferior one. We're making that up, aren't we? Because we're thinking I know better than they do. And we don't see that. If we don't see that, then we're deluded. So it is very difficult. And it's not easy to see through. That's why we keep on investigating. Even though we think we may have had a direct experience of reality, we don't stop investigating. We keep on looking. When we, especially, you know, when we have that thought, I know, I think I know, and that other person doesn't, then really investigate. So we can use these little mantras like, are you sure? Are you sure? Because that can help let go and realize a deeper experience of reality. But we may have some, there's some, maybe some truth in it. Maybe we do have some understanding, and maybe that person does have a certain amount of delusion. There may be some relative truth, but it's still deluded, because we're still separating this person. We're creating separation between me and me, the knower, and the world out there that's known, and that we are judging it. We're creating this idea of I know being superior. That person doesn't. They're inferior. You know, we're measuring and comparing ourselves to other people, which is clearly deluded. So that when you see that, you're not taken in by it anymore. When you see through that, and so that a director experience of reality will happen on various levels. We think we know, and then we realize we're taken in again. So we keep on investigating.